Do you want to just let us know what exactly are you charged with, and when are you going to jail?
So originally, all of us were charged with 3 counts of conspiracy. So conspiracy to commit mischief, conspiracy to assault police, and conspiracy to obstruct police. And I also had some counseling charges on top of that. And I also had a breach of bail. But that's not what we pled to. What we pled to was 2 counts of counseling for myself and Alex. So counseling to commit mischief and counseling to obstruct police. And then the other 4 people who pled only to the counsel to mischief. So what we've actually been convicted of is different from what we were originally charged with. And I'm going to be sentenced on January 13th.
Okay. And what kind of time are you looking at doing?
Well, we have a joint, a joint position. So the Crown and the defense have decided together that on a 20-month sentence. So the way that it's been pitched to the court is 20 months minus 4 months of dead time. So that's like the time that I spent in jail already and some credit for the house arrest and the conditions. That goes down to 16. So right now it's listed as 16 months. And then the assumption, I guess, in Canada is that you do 2/3 of that. So I'm looking at 10 and 2/3.
Just take us back to what it was like when you first heard that the G20 was coming, and like, what was your reaction as an activist living in Guelph?
Well, we first actually heard only about the G8, so that reaction was kind of like, oh, it's so far, how are we going to get people up to Huntsville? Like, should we even get people up to Huntsville? Having that whole sort of old school summit hopping debate. And I think the idea at the time was that actually it was kind of a waste of time and resources to take a bunch of people up to Huntsville, and that we should do something in a large city. We were looking at either Ottawa or Toronto, and sort of discussions were in the works. And then when the G20 was called for Toronto, then it just became obvious that stuff was going to happen in Toronto. So I got involved actually really early on, back in the day before the G20 was even called. So I started coming to meetings in Toronto. And I was kind of one of only a few people in Guelph who were doing that. And I think that's just because I was part of the anti-globalization movement, and I kind of have more of a background in that kind of organizing, sort of like intercity summit stuff. So to me it seemed obvious, but a lot of people in Guelph are like, we're not really interested in that kind of stuff. Yeah, so I'd say I think the first meeting that I went to about it was in like 2008.
Then we sort of find out that in the court case material, that there's evidence that there's been a tremendous amount of resources that the police put into going after organizers, to, you know, infiltrating the movement, you know, surveillance, all of this kind of stuff. Do you think that, like, why do you think that they did that in the first place? Was it like a foregone conclusion that if there was a G20, that there would be a riot, and that, you know, that this was, there was like a, the left was really worth keeping tabs on? Or was this a sort of state overreaction? Or
I mean, I feel like if they've been paying attention to the way summits go down, they could probably have assumed that there was going to be like a lot of things on the street on that day. But they were in too early for that. Like, they were already in, you know, at the start of 2009, and I can't remember, I don't even know if the G20 had even been called at that time. I think it was still just the G8. Mm-hmm. So there was kind of I think the 2 undercovers that I'm the most familiar with, Brendan Collard and Guelph and Waterloo, they came in around the time of the Olympics, and their sort of focus was the Olympics, and then it kind of morphed into the G8, G20 when it got later. But even before that, like in 2008, I was placed under surveillance by the OPP, and they have to sort of make a request to the OPP if they want to surveil someone. And
to the judges, you mean?
Probably to a JP. I'm not sure how it works. Like, if you have a warrant, you make it to a JP and you like show why you think it's necessary, and the JP signs off on it. I'm not sure how it works within the OPP, but there was some form that was filled out that had my name on it, and it was sort of like a justification for why they were asking for surveillance on me. This was 2008, and the reason was, I don't remember the wording exactly, but it was because I was involved in extremist left groups, but then they mentioned like the CSA, the University of Guelph, and
which is the Central Student Association.
A Central Student Association, and like PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, which first of all I'm not a part of, second of all is not an extreme left group. So they had all these things, but then underneath that they said that I was involved in Aboriginal support, and that I was acting as a bridge between Guelph and Toronto and Ottawa for that kind of work, or something along those lines. And so, and that's been sort of a recurring theme, that when the Crown, in their synopsis, they talk a lot about Indigenous solidarity work. And then another thing they talk about, although a bit less, is like migrant justice work. And so I think that they had people who were sort of keeping tabs on people in Guelph and on people in Kitchener-Waterloo for that reason, and that was their main concern, and that it morphed when the ISU sort of came into being, that they found a focus, and they focused on the Olympics, and they focused on the G20, but I think they used files and information from prior investigations.
And what kind of Indigenous movements were you involved with that they were concerned about?
Well, I, see, at the, this is the thing. At the time, like, I'm not good with time, but back in 2008, I would say nothing particularly structured. Like, I probably had gone to some demonstrations. There was an Indigenous Solidarity Movement chapter in Guelph, like, pretty brief, not particularly, like, useful, I would say. But I was going to a lot of events. I was helping to run events through OPIRG. There was some Six Nations Solidarity stuff, presumably, at that time. And mostly like Tiendanega support work, but really, like, I would have considered myself pretty peripheral to that. But Guelph as a whole was very much into that kind of organizing and just like that sort of politics. So, yeah, so the reason that I'm not really sure that I actually was a bridge between Toronto and Guelph and Ottawa, but I do know a lot of people in those cities who do that work. So, yeah, but I think that they don't, I think that they really don't like, I think they were worried about a few things. The main things being, you know, settler communities working with Indigenous people. And secondly, I think they were really worried about the networking that was happening in Southern Ontario. Like, they didn't like that Kitchener and Guelph and Hamilton were working really closely together, and there was a lot of anarchist activity, a lot of organizing. And I think that they did not like that.
And there was also the fact that Guelph has been a real hotspot for ELF and ALF activities, right, over the last number of years?
Yeah, mostly ELF, I'd say. Not so much ALF. Mostly Earth Liberation Front, like, sort of in the early 2000s. And there definitely were investigating those sorts of things. Like, I was pulled into an interrogation, I got arrested in 2008 in November and got pulled into an interrogation about that stuff. Like, they still haven't charged anyone with all of those things. And so already there was an investigation happening into that. And when I had my preliminary inquiry onto those charges, I found some information that should have been blacked out that said that I was a person of interest. So I kind of pursued that a bit and called up some OPP people onto the stand. Like, the guy who came in to interrogate me, his name is John Dyer. He works out of Ottawa. So he was already part of some sort of investigative team. And this is a guy whose name comes up, like, all over our disclosure into this current investigation. I don't think there's a whole lot of, like, undercover investigators or, like, a whole lot of teams in the OPP, so the same names kind of crop up. And
so what can you tell us about the security apparatus response to your organizing and the others around G20? Like, how did the police respond to you? What kind of strategies and tactics did they use to try to infiltrate the movement? And what can you tell us about what they did around this situation?
Well, they kind of, I mean, this is just my opinion. I think other people have other opinions on this. in my opinion, they just did everything right. So they came into our communities. I mean, I'm most familiar with Khaled, I guess. So he came into Guelph and he started working with the Hanlon Creek Business Park, the people opposing that development in Guelph. And that was an above-ground group called Limits. You know, they threw public meetings, they had petitions, they spoke with city council, they had debates, you know, they had a big sign-up sheet and they wanted lots of people to join, and they wanted, you know, a really diverse group of people to join. Like, so it was like a community open group. So he joined that, started going to a lot of stuff, started doing a lot of work, kind of like met people in that group who were more connected to people with more radical politics. And there was crossover between that group and people who ended up doing an occupation of that site. So he ended up at the occupation. So really, like, I would say it's a complication of the lack of division in Guelph, which is probably common to lots of other places, between the above ground stuff. I mean, and the occupation wasn't even underground, but it was illegal. So like it was a very easy slide for him into that other sort of side of things. But at the same time, like, if I had to think about if we were to do that again, I mean, I'm not quite sure how we would even prevent that. Like, you do want lots of people joining your email list and you do want them helping out. And then if they are solid, then, you know, they're just gonna, I just think it would be complicated to sort of monitor that. So, that's how he did it anyways. And he just became, that's how he did it in Guelph.
Were there things about his behavior or activity that had people questioning whether or not he was, could be trusted, or whether he was, a cop or what have you?
Yeah, there was stuff. The problem is, like, I wasn't all that involved in the Hanlon Creek stuff, mainly because I was on bail conditions at the time, so I couldn't go to that demo, and for lots of reasons, I just wasn't as involved as other people. So, but I had heard, that there were people who didn't trust him. And then I had heard, you know, people being like, oh, such bullshit, you know, like, we can't be like this about people, you know, just because, you know, he's brown and just because he's older, like, you know, like, people need to calm down kind of thing and, like, not be so suspicious and blah, blah, blah. So there was that kind of debate happening in Guelph. And then, but eventually he did get kicked out of the occupation. And I'm not sure the circumstances, like, but I know that that happened. And what I've heard is that then the sort of the backlash from that became that he allied with like an indigenous man who was at the occupation also, and a couple of other people, to sort of be like, oh, you know, these Guelph kids are so racist. So there was sort of like a confusion where some people were like, yeah, he's sketchy, we don't want him here, and other people were just like, whoa, this is such bad politics. And in the end he did get kicked out, and then he sort of found his way to Kitchener, where he got involved in Kitchener. And I think he was probably going back and forth a bit between Guelph and Kitchener at the time. But once he was kicked out of Guelph, he was pretty much gone from Guelph, and then showed up more in the Kitchener scene. And in Kitchener, what he did, and this is just according to, like, the disclosure, not from personal knowledge, is that he sort of hooked up with one person in particular and, like, did a lot of criminal things, like, did some illegal things and sort of built a base of, like, well, we're both doing illegal things here.
Like illegal activist things, or
no, just like, you know, like buying cigarettes from the reserve, that kind of stuff. I don't actually know. I think, like, some drugs, like some just like sort of more like standard illegal things. Anyways, and for whatever, like, however, had this way of, like, gaining the trust of one person in particular, and then used that to get into an organizing group in Kitchener.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a totally different approach that he used there.
And so he came in before the G20 stuff was on the horizon. And then,
yeah, before the Olympics.
Right.
Yeah.
And what about the case of the agent known as Brenda? What's your take on how she was involved, and what kind of strategy did she use to get into the activist movement? Because both of these individuals were involved in some of the key spokes councils, or mm-hmm. you know, meetings of the Southern Ontario Anarchist, is it resistance, or
mm-hmm.
yeah
so she came in through like, she was, like, very intentional. So she came in to Guelph in, like, I think late 2008 or very early 2009, like January. And she, you know, had these instructions from her handlers at the OPP that she was to go and, you know, sit at the cornerstone, because a lot of lefties go there and just, like, sit around and just, like, be seen, you know, as someone in, like, a cool, like, kind of progressive coffee shop. So she was actually getting paid to be in a place eating her lunch while she was also getting her lunch paid for. and then she went out and she sort of, she bought these books and she watched some films, you know? So she was like, well, I guess she kind of assessed what she knew of the information of Guelph, and she read like really superficial books on a lot of different topics. And it's kind of embarrassing that, you know, that this worked for her.
Like, what kind of books?
So she read, I think, Animal Rights and Human Wrongs, the Peter Singer book. I think that's what it's called, right?
Mm-hmm.
The main Peter Singer book. And then she read One Dead Indian. She watched Transamerica, like, really, like, mainstreamy, superficial stuff to just, like, get a general politics of the movement, which is sad and kind of pathetic. And then she just basically, like, she had a list of people who were her targets, they were called, and she just sort of went to events, and she started on campus, and she went to events looking for the people whose, I guess, she had photographs, looking for, like, FaceTime with targets, is a quote from the disclosure. So she went to, like, an International Women's Day event, and she was like, no targets here, and then did some other stuff, and then eventually wound up at a GUTS meeting, which is the Guelph Union of Tenants and Supporters, which was trying to, like, branch out and recruit on campus. So she went to that. Hardly anyone showed up, so she was one of, like, you know, four kind of new members, which is always, like, exciting. And then she started working with GUTS, and so she basically, who at the time were doing, like, really very legal stuff, like tenant advocacy and, like, once a week meals on the street corner. So she just started cooking, right? Like, doing grunt work, basically like Khalid. Mm-hmm. Coming in, like, you know, in a totally not sketchy, in a way that, like, kind of, like, younger people in Guelph are just like, wow, like, there's, like, you know, older people who are actually getting involved, because it doesn't really happen so much. So it's really exciting that both of them were involved, right? And that, so the cooking was done at people's houses, and then it was just, like, people kind of, like, became more friendly, and then people were talking more when she was in the room, and then it just kind of merged into, like, people were talking about the G8 and the G20. And it wasn't even that people were saying sketchy stuff, it was more just that she's like, okay, these are the people. Like, these are the people that I should be getting in tight with. So I've hit the jackpot, you know, through this cooking, and now I'm going to get to know these people a lot better and follow them. And I don't know how she got to that first meeting in Guelph, because I was at the Olympics at the time. Like, I don't know if it wasn't an invite-only thing or if she was actually invited because enough people had been around her for long enough that they trusted her. I don't really know. But she ended up at that first meeting of SOAR before there was a vouch system in place. And then she just kind of breezed through all the rest. So I don't think anyone ever sat down and said, okay, who here is officially vouching for Brenda? Like, I think she just kind of, like, slipped by that whole process just from having been there right at the start.
And SOAR didn't have, like, a very terribly developed ideological perspective either, right? Like, you didn't have to sort of prove that you were an anarchist, just that you thought things were messed up and you wanted to do something about it.
Well, SOAR was kind of, I mean, as I understand it, it was more to try to bring together people who had already been working together in, like, a really informal network. And, you know, like I said before, the networking at that time was really amazing. Like, people had been working together on a lot of different projects. People were starting to really trust each other across the cities. And so it was kind of an attempt to more officially bring those people together at the start. I think that was the point of it at the start. So it didn't need to be ideological, because it was just people that everyone knew, like, that already knew each other,
mm-hmm.
for the most part. And I think after that it kind of branched out, and then it became more of like a, well, you know, this person knows these people and therefore they're cool, and it doesn't matter so much if I don't know them. So then it kind of got bigger and bigger, But I mean, that wasn't even where the problem was. Like, she was in it from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. So. How important were things like Facebook and social media to the work that the undercovers were doing? Did that come up at all in the disclosure?
I mean, they had Facebook accounts, and there was actually even, I guess they're not undercovers because we're in an office, but there was cops who their only role, it seems, in the whole operation was to make fake Facebook profiles and, like, add themselves to events and, like, get information about the events. Hmm. Which, I don't know how useful that was in the long run, but Brenda and Khaled both had Facebook profiles. And so I guess they would just get all of the events and stuff. And I mean, I guess there's also an aspect of that thing where it's like, oh, all of my friends are friends with this person on Facebook, so I might as well add them. Like, I'm sure there's probably a bit of that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it played like a, other than sort of, I mean, if they read my Facebook profile, they'd get a pretty good sense of my politics, which probably didn't help me in the end. But other than that, I don't think it was specific. I know they used it, but I wouldn't know how useful it was to them.
So they went on to infiltrate the SOAR meetings, and then Brenda had an actual, like, audio, like, was wearing a wire to some of these meetings and recording stuff that was said at the meetings, right?
Only the last one. So, like, and they had to work pretty hard for that wire, too. Like, there's a 100-page, I can't remember what the name of it is, but the document that you have to create to, in order to justify a wire, like, it's, like, 100 pages long. They had to run that by a GP who approved it, and then she just wore it to the last meeting on the 25th. Mm-hmm. and I don't know if that was a device that was broadcasting simultaneously, which mm-hmm. I know you can do, like if the cop car's sitting outside, it can just be transferring, or if it was just recording onto a tape, I'm not sure. Right. But it was a body pack.
So when you get arrested, you start going through this trial process, and when you look at the evidence that was before you, did you feel that there was just so much evidence that was against you guys that you just had to plea out, and that they quote unquote got you, or was this a matter of other political considerations that you felt that you should, that it made more sense to take a plea deal and plead out to stuff, not to the conspiracy stuff, and end up doing time?
It definitely wasn't a matter of people feeling that the evidence was overwhelming. Mainly, I think, because conspiracy is so convoluted and confusing that we didn't have a good way to judge the evidence.
Conspiracy law, you mean?
Conspiracy law, yeah. So the kind of evidence you'd need to see to make a conspiracy conviction. Like, I'm not to this day clear on if what was in the disclosure, like, would have amounted to even the right type of evidence, let alone the right amount. Like, I have no idea. It's so confusing. And, I mean, my lawyer told me once that I should just look at the Watts manual for jury instructions and read the one for conspiracy. And he's like, it's so ridiculously confusing. Like, even the Supreme Court does not really understand conspiracy law. So definitely we didn't look at it and say, oh man, like we're fucked, like we should plead out. But there was definitely a sense that there was a potential for a conviction because we didn't really know. And so there's a potential for a conspiracy conviction, which people for the most part thought would be a really bad precedent. Because the thing about conspiracy is that anything that's being planned that is illegal, if they hadn't been able to convict us, like, it doesn't matter what the illegal thing is that you're talking about. So even if what they thought that we were talking about was some, like, really violent thing or, you know, a really huge thing when it wasn't, it wouldn't even matter, because even the smallest illegal thing could lead, like, legally to a conspiracy charge. And so the concern is that, you know, people planning stuff like Occupy or, like, really benign, like, NVDA kind of actions with this precedent could be in line for, like, them using conspiracy more often. And in that case, it's kind of like cats out of the bag, you know? And so that, whether right or wrong, that was, like, the feeling that a lot of us had. And so just the threat or the potential of a conviction was sort of like me. Like, that was a consideration. But there was tons of other considerations as well. There was, you know, just a lot of people ideologically were like, it's a waste of time to fight this in the courts. You know, people say that, you know, like, they completely disagreed with the idea that we would be caving, that we'd be giving in, or, like, giving them more power, because they're like, no, like, we'll have more power if we get this over with and get back to work. And there's very, like, little use that you can make out of even a victory. So some people felt that way. Other people just looked at, you know, the amount of time and, like, the effects that that would have on their organizing and on their personal lives as well. And just were like, you know, I mean, basically, we're, for the most part, we're all going to be out before our trial would have even started. So it's like a time difference as well. And that was like a personal, but also political consideration. And then there was also the potential deportation, which was a consideration. And for me, that was like the main consideration, that we needed to find a way to make sure that nobody who was deportable was going to be convicted. So that was long-winded. No, sorry.
That's fine.
But yeah, there was lots of considerations, and those are a few of them.
Okay, so I just want to focus on a few particular moments in the timeline, because at one point, immediately after you were, you know, there's a group of, I'm not sure how many, 20, 30 people that were arrested before the G20 protests actually started. And, you know, the police said, okay, we've got the, you know, the core conspirators, the key leaders that were responsible for this violence. And then they said, you know, they put forward some very harsh conditions around non-association and, you know, essentially would only release you under house arrest. And I'm just wondering if you can expand a little bit on, in, you know, in retrospect, do you think it made sense to have accepted those conditions, or would have it made sense to tough it out in jail for a while and try to build, you know, support, you know, for movement leaders, you know, who had been jailed at that point, or what, like, do you think that that was an important kind of turning point that kind of set the tone for the legal strategy that you followed, or what could you say about that?
Well, I'd say that I'm never doing that again. Like, I would not take those conditions again. And I would go into an arrestable action with, like, with the understanding that I could be in jail for months and months. So, like, with, like, things wrapped up, not just, like, wrapped up for the weekend until you get out, but, like, really wrapped up. That would be what I would do. I can't speak for other people, but I think that it definitely, I mean, I think more than anything, what set the tone was the fact that we had lawyers. I don't know if we had taken those conditions and had refused to have lawyers, I think that would have been a totally different tone as well.
So explain how that would have worked.
Well, what's happened in the past, and I don't know if it would have this time because it was a conspiracy charge, but in the past when I have not used a lawyer, I have not been able to have non-association conditions. So, I mean, I really think that what hindered us the most at the start is that we all got out and we got shipped off. And we couldn't talk to each other. So we had
shipped,
like,
off in terms of being sent back to,
to, like, the suburbs of somewhere, you know? Like, people were all living in, like, different cities. Like, I was pretty far away. Monica was in, you know, the Maritimes.
Back with their parents or family members. So,
like, yeah. And so, to me, like, what would have been ideal would have been we all get out, or not, but we have a way to meet. And if we had stayed in jail, we would at least have been able to meet, like, the men would have been able to meet together, the women would have been able to meet together, we were all on the same ranges. And so I think that we could have sort of had a bit more time to, like, have conversations, because we had never had any conversations, because, I mean, we weren't, like, a group of 17 people with a plan, you know? And so we had never talked about things like, you know, how do you feel about non-association? We'd never done that kind of, like, pre-arrest stuff that you do if you're doing, like, a cohesive action with a group of people. So we would have had time to do those things if we had not signed the non-association. And if we had stayed in jail. So, yeah, so I think it would have been different for sure if we hadn't signed, but I'm not sure, like, what specific conditions were the worst, or whether it was just the fact that we had, like, lawyers who really were making everyone really paranoid.
Because from the lawyer standpoint, the primary objective is to get you out of jail at whatever the cost you know, so, yeah. And then fight it out on a legal basis later.
Yeah.
But the organizing isn't foregrounded as being all that important, the future organizing that happens.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? The lawyers, like, have a, like a, you know, professional code, ethic or whatever, and that ethic involves, like, you get your people out and you deal with that the rest later. And they would tell us stuff like that, you know, and I remember even saying, like, it's not my experience that it's really easy to change bail conditions once you've signed them. My experience is actually the opposite, that once you've signed it, it's really hard and you should hold out for the best that you can get. Like, you should hold out for, you should only sign the thing that you assume you're going to have until trial. Like, you should never sign something on the assumption that, oh, it's okay, it'll get better later.
Mm-hmm.
My experience has always been, like, sign the thing that you're going to be stuck with. And I remember arguing with my lawyer about that. And he was, like, adamant, like, no, 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 this is, you know, they're just, like, playing it up because of the media. Everything will die down and then just keep your heads down. And in a few months, you know, we'll sort it out. And I should not have believed him. but I mean, yeah, everybody wanted to get out, basically. I mean, there wasn't, we didn't have, like, a real discussion in jail that I can remember that was, like, should we stay here? Like, people hadn't prepared for that. People had stuff at home that was hanging. People had work. Like, people hadn't sort of thought that through. So,
I mean, I guess it's kind of tricky because on the one hand, this does mark a new, you know, like, there's something qualitatively new about this. So this is the first time, at least in my, you know, experience of being politically active for the last almost 20 years, of, you know, a bunch of, you know, radical left activists in Canada ending up doing serious jail time for a year or two, you know, 2 years. And I agree with what you're saying in terms of, well, maybe we have to be much more prepared to see jail as a logical outcome of our activism. But in that case, how do you, you know, how do you get people involved with stuff where it's like, okay, so you want to take part in organizing the G20 stuff, you want to be, you know, you want to help lead this, you know, quote unquote lead this stuff if you're anarchist, but if you want to play a leading important role in this, you should be prepared that when they arrest you, as they seem to have done in every case of the sort of large summit-based protesting, they've sort of preemptively swooped in and arrested the main organizers that they've identified and then given them a really you know, serious charges. You know, in some sense, you have to prepare people for that. But on the other hand, you don't want to set it up so that it's like the only people that can do that organizing are people that are willing to sit in jail for months on end until their conditions change.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have thoughts on? I mean, I guess it sort of boils down into this kind of political question of like how can you be prepared for that eventuality and be able to build a political movement on the outside that's able to point to, you know, the ridiculous things that are happening, you know, because there was that movement for a while, a week or two after the G20 happened, and there were these mass arrests of 3,000 people, and there were some very powerful protests in Toronto where, you know, people were chanting, you know, let our friends go outside of the police station, and there were, you know, big name speakers that were talking about the, you know, the criminality of the police in making these mass arrests and in going after people the way they did.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think another thing that people really need to think about is the publication ban. Like,
mm-hmm.
That's not really answering your question, but
yeah.
Because I think that what happened is that it was really difficult, like, from the outside, once we had signed, once we had put in place a publication ban, which we did, like, the defense did, and I never was asked by my lawyer, you know, if I wanted that, I wouldn't have wanted that. But once the publication ban was in place, it was really hard for people to know, like what they could do on our behalf. Anyway, there was a lot of complications with, like, any kind of sort of protests on behalf of the conspiracy people. One of them was that people didn't know what they could say, or if they could even say anything. And another was that there's this weird loophole kind of strange thing in the conspiracy law that nobody really understood, that at the time seemed to mean that if you were a part of the conspiracy, and if at a later date in court you were deemed to have actually been a part of the conspiracy, then anything that you said, even after arrest, anything you say is assumed to have been said by anyone in the group. So everyone was scared to speak without the consent of the group, which we couldn't get because we had non-association. And then there was also this idea of, like, the non-indicted or the unindicted co-conspirator, which is, like, people who haven't been arrested, but they're considered part of the conspiracy. And then if they speak, are they also getting us in more trouble? And so they didn't want to speak either. But anyways, that's, like, that's one thing where I think that that just means people just need to study this stuff and see what is actually the law and, like, what is actually the, what are the restrictions, and know it better next time. Because we just didn't know, so we were like, well, if there's any chance, we shouldn't do it.
Although in a sense, that's almost a losing battle, because it's like, it requires highly specialized legal knowledge, and you're saying even in, you know, and even in, around these cases, the Supreme Court isn't, you know, necessarily clear on what qualifies conspiracy and how that relates to conspiracy of a political nature, you know, where there's also questions of your charter rights to protest and to express yourself. And
I mean, I think questions. There are, I think there are answers to those specific questions. Like, you know, is something said by an unindicted co-conspirator after the arrest, can it go back to an arrested? Like, I feel like those specific, there are specific things about conspiracy that with a bit of work we could figure out. If people want to put the time into that. But yeah, to to answer the question about, like, people being prepared for jail, I feel like it's kind of the same as the question of, like, the undercovers, right? Like, there's a, some kind of balance somewhere about, you know, how do you try to avoid infiltration while trying to get the largest number of people involved that you can? And then, you know, how do you keep people involved without seeming like it's a really scary thing or, like, a huge sacrifice while, like, actually making sure that at least some people are willing to make that sacrifice? And I don't know. I mean, ideally, I mean, maybe we could have done it that, like, some people did take their conditions if they needed to do that, and other people didn't. Maybe it doesn't have to be, like, all or nothing, you know? Mm-hmm. But I feel like there's a lot of value to just, like, to people being prepared for, to do time. And, like, maybe that means that if this is the work you're going to do, then you don't do other things, right? Like, so maybe don't get involved in the masters that you cannot consider, like, being interrupted. Or maybe, like, you think a little more seriously about, like, having kids and, like, having responsibilities like that, knowing that, like, these are the consequences. And if people then do the work who are, have thought this through, and are in, then they'll be in a position to take that on. I feel like that's a lot to ask of people.
Was the reason for getting the publication banned in the first place, was that because of the evidence that the undercovers had gathered, that they had, you know, that they had people talking, you know, a lot of crap about stuff that they wanted to do, or that stuff that was said maybe in the in a kind of macho posturing way, but, you know, wasn't really meant, it was sort of a joke, but that it would make them look really bad if it came out publicly?
No, I think a publication ban is just a standard. It's a standard thing.
But what was the rationale for wanting it in the first place?
I don't know. It wasn't my lawyer who did it. I think it's, you just always ask for a publication ban. Like, it's basically, it's a tool of the defense, right? It's set up to protect the defense. So it's basically, like, the idea behind it, I think, is good. It's like, you know, at a bail hearing, the only person really talking is the Crown. Like, you haven't had time to look at this. It's not real evidence. Like, their synopsis is outrageous, right? Like, we're terrorists in the synopsis, and that's what they say. And then the JP is like, well, it's not my job to see if this evidence is real or not, but if it's possibly real, that's what I'm dealing with. So they don't assess that. So the Crown just can say anything they want. And then that's what would be in the paper. And the defense doesn't counter, right? And then the same thing all the way through the preliminary inquiry, like, the first people to go, the first person, or the first side to go is the Crown, and they run, basically, all of their witnesses first, and the defense can come in and, like, do cross-examination, but it's a preliminary, so the judge is really only looking to see if there's enough evidence, if it was true, that we could proceed to trial. So again, like, the evidence is, like, they're just throwing everything out there. So the idea is to protect the defense from, like, a biased jury, because all of that stuff that's so one-sided has come out in the media. And so it's standard, like, most defense ask for it. And if, like, if the defense ask for it, they get it. Even if only one of our lawyers had to do it, and then it was all of us, right? And the Crown can't say, no, you can't have a publication ban, because it's like the side. It's like a protection for the defense. And so it's just a common thing. The lawyers probably didn't even think to ask us, because they're like, well, of course they're going to want one. But what it meant is that, like, we couldn't say anything about what was happening in the court or even the synopsis, right? And I think that, you know, we could have done a media campaign. We could have countered it in our own media campaign if that stuff had been printed in the papers.
And would that also meant that you could have referred to material in the disclosure that you got and sort of debunked it? Or is the disclosure always off limits?
It's always off limits. Okay. Because it's only when it's brought up in court that it's part of the official record, and then you can talk about it. But not the disclosure itself.
Do you feel that there were ways in which the activists organizing for the, you know, organizing the protests could have conducted themselves differently, you know, themselves, to have been able to avoid the kind of state repression that they faced?
Yeah, totally. Well, I mean, it's hard to say, right? Like, I think that what didn't help us was the stuff you were talking about, like the posturing, like the, you know, partially, like, just, like, being not very smart. Or
what are some examples of that?
Well, you know, like, we had a brainstorm one time where we were just throwing out, like, anything, you know, like you do, because it's a brainstorm. And partially this is the undercover's fault for not knowing what a brainstorm is, right? So it's like, partially it's like a problem with, like, people talking all big and trying to one-up each other, but then it's also a problem of, like, this huge culture gap between police and activists, where, like, we know that most of the shit on a brainstorm board is not going to happen, and that most stuff is kind of a joke, or, like, can be.
So we need better training for the it. We need better training for the police to teach them that
exactly.
We're really
we need
not
to train the police
serious.
But no, so one example is that, you know, like, we were talking about potential things that could be done around the delegates' arrival. And by we, I'm talking about a very specific group of people, myself included. And we were, you know, one of the things that got thrown out was, well, we could, like, make it so it's impossible to land at the airport. And how could we do that? Like, what would set off an alarm at the airport? You know, kind of the same thing that people do when there's deportations about to happen. But one of the things that was like, yeah, we can get a really shitty car and run it through the chain link fence, which, like, you know, obviously, if you know us, we're probably not going to do, right? But it is like a possible.
So the
car, right? Like, you know, that's not going to happen. But I mean, in a different world, in a different time, with different resources, I mean, I don't know if that would really work, but it's not a tactic we would necessarily, like, not say, right? Like, maybe it could work. So that's in the disclosure, right? And it's like, I think that the cop in the room actually thought that maybe that's something that we were going to do. And if that's what they thought about all the things like that, like, we look like we have a lot more resources and capacity than we actually had. And I mean, so a lot of that is just like, it's not that I don't approve of that tactic. I just, we're not in a space that we could really do that at that time, right? So a lot of, like, very innocent and, like, you know, totally reasonable things like that were just taken as possibilities when they really weren't possibilities. But then there's other stuff that's, like, really outrageous, and I can't really think of examples right now, but where it's just kind of, like, macho, like, talking about, like, you know, what I would do with a cop if I found him, you know, or, you know, like, stuff that is kind of like, actually, I don't really think you would do that. And, like, it's not, like, wasn't useful to the conversation. It was just chatting. So those kinds of things all got recorded too. And all the stuff that got recorded as, like, taken as, you know, as the same. So that had the same value and not interpreted and, like, not followed by everybody left or, you know, stuff like that. There's no tone of voice in the disclosure. There's no, like, qualifying remarks or anything. Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of stuff, like, I mean, I don't think you want to sort of act all the time as if there's an informant in the room. Like, I guess you kind of do, but it would make things really kind of annoying if you were like, And now, informant, we are crossing off all the things of this brainstorm sheet that are clearly not going to happen. And I will say them to you in case you're recording this conversation, you know?
But, I mean, even if you say that, they're not required to also provide that. I mean, it's almost like it might just be better not to say anything that's really stupid or mm-hmm. really illegally outrageous or something that mm-hmm. you wouldn't be willing to stand behind, you know, having splashed in the front page of the Toronto Star.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. I think that's the difference, right? Because I personally would stand behind a tactic of, like, going through a chain link fence, setting off an alarm at an airport to, like, stop a plane from taking off for deportation. Or, I mean, there's like times when I think that that is a direct action that's, like, valuable, right? That could be done. And so that's the distinction, is, like, I think those things can still get you in trouble, but I'm not sure that it's, like, the best course of action to just never talk about them in case someone's listening. But I think there's a lot of stuff that really didn't need to be said, you know, and wasn't useful. And, you know, maybe it's like, you're looking a little tougher, but, like, I don't know. Mm-hmm.
What do you feel the level of fallout has been on the activists that were involved with the G20 organizing? Like, do you feel that they were, or that you were, you know, like, you went through this process and you was, like, going through a meat grinder and you're just like, like, we're screwed. We've been, you know, people are falling back, they're not wanting to sort of step forward with political stuff, they've been scared off, or do you feel like this process has sort of clarified some stuff and strengthened people's you know, understanding of what's at stake and what's required? Like, has it been like, how do you assess the, you know, the last year and a half or so with this whole kind of situation?
I really don't know. I mean, I know what I'd like to think. I'd like to think that people are like, having better, like, conversations with themselves and with other people about what they're willing to do, what they're willing to give up, and, like, knowing that, like, there's consequences that maybe they hadn't thought of before. Like, how are they going to organize better next time? And I've heard stuff, like, I was on house arrest for so long that I was really out of the loop, but I've heard that, you know, in Toronto, right after the G20, there was a lot of people getting involved with Known as Legal and with OCAP, which was partially one of the goals of the TCMN, was to, like, use the G20 as a way to sort of get people excited and then go into groups that were organizing in the city. But I heard that, and I don't know if that's the case. I think that, like, I imagine if you were one of the people who got, you know, attacked at Queen's Park on that day, like, you have a pretty different understanding of riot police at this point. And I don't know, I guess for some people that probably makes them not want to do stuff. But I remember, like, when I had that first moment of, like, oh my God, we're really enemies, it made me just, like, really a lot madder. So hopefully there's more than half the people who are, you know, having a better sort of understanding of the state and police and where they fit, and, like, what your right to protest really means and what it doesn't mean. But yeah, I don't have a good way of knowing if that's the case. I think in terms of, like, prison solidarity, it's done, like, wonders. Like, the number of people, even just, like, people on my Facebook, you know, who are involved in, like, you know, like, letter writing stuff and, like, actually just posting more stuff about C10 and, like, you know, programs in prisons and, like, stuff like I feel like wouldn't normally be posted by those people, like, that's grown exponentially. So I don't know if that's, like, taking away from other work, but it seems like that work is, like, really strong, and, like, you know, noise demos and just, like, a lot more focus on prisoners as a political issue. Mm-hmm. I think it's been really good for that.
Have you guys had any conversations about sort of what you can do as half a dozen activists that are being inserted into the Ontario prison system for, you know, a year or 2 years? Has there been discussions about how you might be able to link the struggles happening within the prison to the activist struggles on the outside?
Yeah, well, I've been thinking a lot about that. I didn't get much time. I mean, when we were negotiating the deal, we were meeting and we were only talking about the deal. And then the guys went in like a week later. So I haven't talked really to them. And I think maybe because their sentences are a lot shorter, that's probably less stuff that they're thinking about. I don't know. I also haven't talked that much to Leah about it, who's already inside. But I've been having a lot of conversations with people who do prison solidarity work, mostly around publishing. There seems to be a sense that, like, one thing that could be really useful in the provincial system is a way for people to get their stories out or to just be published.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, like, a project that I'm trying to take on for while I'm inside. But I think in terms of linking struggles of the people on the inside to struggles of the people on the outside, I kind of feel like it needs to wait until I know who those people are. I mean, the obvious one in the maximum security wing is immigration, right? So many people are there for, like, immigration stuff, but I'm not sure that that's where I'm going to end up.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I feel like other than really broad sort of, like, you know, poverty and racism, like, it's hard to know exactly what sorts of things would be useful, but... I mean, I have a few projects that I want to do, just like really simple things, like trying to make it so that newspapers can get brought onto the range and trying to merge the canteens so that they're not gendered.
What would that accomplish?
It just means that what is available to the guys at Maplehurst is the same as what's available to the women at Vanier. And I had thought of it just basically because I was like, fuck, I want to read The Economist, not like Chatelaine. Like, I was kind of like... just like annoyed at like the gendered nature of it. But when I was talking to somebody in Montreal recently, they were like, and I hadn't thought of this, but that it's even more important for like trans prisoners, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that, yeah, just so that the stuff is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just no reason, like they're, you know, the two complexes are like side by side. Like there's no reason why I get makeup and they get like fitness magazines, you know? So there's stuff like that, like that I'm hoping to do on the inside, but in terms of the links, other than the publishing, I haven't thought too much about it. But you probably know lots of things that I could do.
What are the forms that solidarity is taking place? Like, are there particular groups or organizations that are doing work around supporting the G20 political prisoners?
Yeah, well, there's some. I mean, specific organizations. There's like one that has sprung up in Kitchener, and I don't know what it's called. And then there's the Guelph ABC, but they were doing this stuff before.
But they're also spearheading a lot of the stuff that's happening now?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't say spearheading. They're kind of like, they're kind of the group that is in Guelph. Yeah, I don't know about other groups. I mean, there is already like a Books to Prisoners group that's functional in Kitchener, so they're kind of doing stuff still. I don't know about new groups, though. I think that if anything, there's more of like a networking between groups, like Guelph and Toronto ABC and like this new Kitchener group with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I don't know if new ones. I just think there's a lot more people involved in it and a lot more people talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Did you find it weird at all reflecting on or relating to the Occupy movement when, you know, you were facing all the charges around the G20 stuff? Because I mean, that kind of came up from almost, you know, out of nothing. It seemed like it just all of a sudden, you know, here's these occupations happening all over the place, and it's in a lot of ways it's a very similar politic to the people that were, you know, spearheading the G20 organizing, and that same kind of direct action anarchist participatory democracy kind of politics did you see a carryover between the G20 organizing and the Occupy stuff, or is it like, what was your reaction to it as it happened?
I was jealous mostly.
Yeah.
But I didn't really follow the Toronto stuff that much. I followed the American stuff, which I think is a different beast and way better
mm-hmm.
than what we had in Canada. The Ottawa stuff, I followed a little bit when I was there, but I mean, I know that in Toronto, some of the same people were involved and some of the same sort of like ways of striking committees, and even the names of the committees were somewhat the same. So I think there was like a bit of organizing influence that happened. I mean, my sort of, it's not related to the G20 so much, but my opinion around the Occupy stuff was just like, like, this is different. I don't agree with a lot of it. Like, I don't agree with their, like, you know, nonviolent, be the victim if the cops come in kind of stance for the most part. But I was sort of like, well, we didn't do, like, a particularly great job at the G20, so let's just, like, leave this alone and see if they have better luck, you know? Like, let's see if this tactic is, like, gets more done or, like, is has a potential for being more successful. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of purposely trying to, like, hang back and just kind of... I mean, people at one point were like, we need, you know, experienced organizers to write stuff or to give advice, and I was like, I don't know, like, if our advice is really all that useful, like... I feel like this is a new thing and it's different and we should just see what happens.
But I mean, are there specific things then that you came out of the your experience around the G20 being like, okay, I'm never going to do that again, or I've really learned that? I mean, you alluded to some of it around, you know, not signing on to conditions or not relying too much on lawyers, but was there anything else that you'd really take out of it?
I mean, I guess, like...
That might be of use for the Occupy people or, you know, other activists in the future?
I mean, I think that the thing that I'm thinking the most about is, like, this notion of illegality and doing time for your actions. And, like, if that's a possibility, then they really need to be effective actions. And, like, so, like, because now I'm doing, you know, almost 11 months for really basically... like, nothing that was particularly effective that was criminal, right? Like, the most effective stuff that I did at the G20 had nothing to do with, like, anything illegal, right?
What was the most effective stuff?
I mean, I just think it was, like, having provided a space and a structure for people to plug in and, like, you know, all of the sort of shit work of the TCMN and call-outs, right? Like, call-outs and, like articles, and I just think, like, it was the sort of everyday stuff that if there hadn't been any talk of, like, affinity group activity, I think the cops would have been sort of stuck as to what exactly they were.
If you just clarify what you think was done most effectively then.
So first of all, I should say that a lot of people would probably disagree with me on this, so I'm speaking only for myself. I think that, like, I think the most effective stuff was the, like, I don't know. I don't really know how to answer that. I mean, I think that the TCMN, which basically was, like, you know, not planning actions, was just coordinating, was, like, you know, making a convergence center, doing logistics, doing transport, all those kind of, like, grunt-worky things. I think that was... the most effective of the organizing that I did. Like, it had the most effective result, because anything else that I might have been planning didn't happen because I was arrested, right? So, and I think that all that could have been done, all that stuff could have been done with no arrests. Like, despite the fact that, you know, the cops tried to make it sound like the TCMN was this, like, terrorist organization that, like, knew about all these criminal things, I actually think that if it had only been the TCMN in the picture, we wouldn't have had this, because they wouldn't have been able to make that fly.
So, I mean, is that an argument then, saying that the black bloc tactics, or, you know, the use of, you know, the whole kind of questions around violence or fighting the cops, I mean, has that made you reconsider your position in regards to those things?
No, not at all. I just think that those things, it's way too sketchy to try to organize those things in any way. So, I mean, I had, like, the way I would have liked this to unfold was, like, kind of a cross between an autonomous black bloc and the way that affinity groups were organized in the anti-globalization movement days. So, like, the pie chart in Seattle, you know, like, divide the city. Is there an affinity group that can shut down this part of the city? Hands up. Awesome. There's 10 of you. Great. Do you need more people? No. Okay, go to it. Right? Go do your thing. Autonomous thing. So I guess, like, the idea behind SOAR, my idea behind SOAR, was that it would allow for a little more cooperation between affinity groups, so that it wasn't just sort of like a random bunch of affinity groups just doing whatever, but that if one affinity group was doing a particular thing, maybe there's another affinity group that could assist, or maybe their two things kind of like would help each other, right? And that's not the way it panned out, but that was kind of the idea that I had, and that was the idea behind the spokescouncils of affinity groups. And like in the end, what happened, like all of the, you know, quote unquote ringleaders were in jail, and completely different people took the lead and like, you know, put up a flare, and a bunch of people followed them, and it was just like a more standard black bloc. Like people were in black, people knew who each other were, they trusted each other, they went and did some stuff. And all of that organization that went into SOAR and all of the time and the energy, it was kind of really unnecessary at the end for like a black bloc in a march, right?
But how would you respond to the critique that, say, a supporter of nonviolent direct action might level at you guys and say, you know, look, we're fighting on the terrain that's set up by the state. You know, they know that, you know, protesters are coming. They've got this huge, you know, kind of fence set up. They have tens of thousands of police officers. You know, at most, all you've got is a couple hundred black bloc people. They're not going to be able to do all that much, you know, other than maybe, you know, light a cop car on fire, shake a fence here or there, run around, you know, tussle with the cops a little bit. So why not just organize everything completely openly and transparently and say, we're going to try to shut it down. We're going to try to use a Seattle model of, you know, affinity groups that are only engaging in sort of civil disobedience. So in that sense, you can't be portrayed as a terrorist or as being violent. And then, you know, you would be able to bring in a lot more people into the movement as a result. And, you know, how'd you deal with that when they would just say, like, look, infiltration is always going to happen. It's not something that you can stop. You could only stop it at the risk of being so paranoid that you couldn't actually do anything.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that if the state of the movement right now was such that Seattle could happen, or like that there are affinity groups out there who act with no bandanas, who do things like hard blockades, who know how to do those things, who have the equipment to do those things, and the like, and are willing to do those things, I think we would have had a really different situation. But I think the assessment that I had and that most people had is that doesn't exist anymore, right? People don't do those things. It's like, it's not the Pacific Northwest, like it's not like anti-logging stuff, it's not the anti-globalization days. And like, you know, sadly, like I walked into those meetings in Toronto and looked around and was like, where is everyone? You know, where are the people who have these skills, who know how to do this stuff? They weren't there. And so, and I remember speaking with like a friend of mine who is super, like completely pacifist and does only NVDA and does it really well, really coordinated. And I was like, are you going to be here? Can we have some yellow actions, you know? And there just wasn't those things. And I think that's a problem because we have, you know, like really boring, not very useful union NGO style marches or black bloc, like no middle. And that is like, that is a problem of like the terrain that we're working with. But I think that, you know, it's not true that we were infiltrated because of SOAR, because Greenpeace was infiltrated. You know, the Vancouver Media Center was infiltrated. A lot of very mainstream groups who, for the most part, do nonviolent civil disobedience, if anything, were infiltrated. That's not why they infiltrate, right? And so I don't think it's true that the infiltration wouldn't happen if there wasn't this, like, idea of, like, quote-unquote violence. And so I'm just trying to answer all the parts of your question. Like, sorry.
I guess I'm just lost in my rambling. I guess there's like a couple different issues here, right? Because it's like, on the one hand, some of the debate around the diversity of tactics debate is a kind of line of like, you can't tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't, you know, we can't have, you know, we can't have a collective decision making as a movement that can say, okay, this event, you know, based upon the array of different forces, means that it would be really dumb to engage in black block stuff because we're going to get smashed and a lot of people are going to go to jail. So we will do no black block event here, and therefore, you know, don't come and don't do that. Whereas at this other situation, you know, it's, you know, it would actually be useful to have, you know, a more direct action that's not respecting the laws of the state and that's not, you know, not just not sort of handing themselves up to be arrested. And then so, you know, we could do this here and, you know, this there. And those are two different kinds of things. And I get maybe to some extent we do that in terms of saying, well, this is going to be a child-friendly march because this is what, you know, we need in order to develop the movement. But it almost seemed in some ways that it was like, it was almost like the black bloc action had become almost symbolic in itself, like as in like, well, it's not a good summit protest unless something's burning, and then that shows, and almost just the act of something having been burned is a victory, even though that's really symbolic in and of itself, and then resulted in these tremendous charges and the, you know, the hardship that yourself and a number of other people are, you know, went through with all the trials and now the jail time. And you could maybe make the argument that if you had read the kind of political situation better and not, you know, not done things that would have allowed the police to paint you in the way that they did, then this could have been minimized.
Well, I mean, the thing is, like, the black bloc in the end, like, I mean, the thing is, what we knew is that the black bloc was going to happen, right? Because it always happens. So, sore or no sore, there's going to be a black bloc. And so the idea that we had, and like we being like SWOR and the TCMN and just generally, was that how does it be as safe as possible, right? So like, how can we use diversity of tactics to separate in time and or space and to like make it so that there is a march where people can do whatever, like, quote unquote militant or whatever stuff they want to do that is not the labor march. And so the original idea was always that like, shit's going to happen. It always happens. We can't control what people from other cities or from other places are going to do. Fair bet there's going to be a black bloc and there's going to be smashed windows. How do we make sure that like they happen in a place and in a way that like doesn't affect the green march or the, you know, low risk march? And so that was the intention, and it didn't work out that way. And it kind of didn't work out that way because of a lack of respect for diversity of tactics, I think. Like, I think that had the labor march right off the bat been like, that's a great idea. We don't want shit to come down on our march. March with us and then go somewhere else, like take people somewhere else. And if that had been like a friendly, cordial, like, we don't agree, but we agree that some people want to do different things, I think it would have actually turned out pretty well. But as to the value of, like, having a small black bloc that runs amok in the city, like, I think that, you know, I don't know. I'm not fully decided either way on that. Like, I think there is some value to, you know, showing a kind of resistance that is, like, militant, that's in your face, that's, like, you know, like, no, you can't scare me with your tear gas, you can't scare me with your guns, like, fuck you. I think that is really valuable in ways that like can't necessarily be assessed, and I don't think the window smashing matters. I don't think the cop cars matter. I think that whatever gives off an aura of like militancy in the street is really valuable, no matter what that's doing. I don't know that a civil disobedience, like lie down and get dragged away kind of action, does do that. I think it does a lot of other great things. But I don't think it encourages, for example, like when I was in jail, like the general consensus on my range was that was fucking awesome, you know? And like, so people who have been constantly harassed by cops who have like a really good class analysis or just experience, right? Thought it was great. And then, you know, like kids who just like hate the cops, hate like this power structure, but don't really have like a background or like an academic understanding of it, were drawn to that in large numbers, and I think that's what's positive. So I don't think it's like assessed by did people get arrested or did we shut it down or are the unions mad at us now? I think it's like there's other things to assess. I just wish that there was a middle ground. Like, I wish that there were people still who are like, we're going to go, we're going to lie down on the gardener. We're not going to let the delegates through. Or, you know, we're going to put a tripod in the middle of the entranceway, or we're going to lock down at the, you know, at the fence. And we're going to do those kinds of things. And we could put a call out for that. Mass nonviolent civil disobedience. But, like, that...
And sorry, you did put a call out?
No, we didn't, but that could have happened, right? Like, I think with the TCMN, the hope was that, like, by embracing a diversity of tactics and just saying, like, the action committee wants to hear what you're doing so we can try to maintain the separation in time and space, make sure that your, like, child-friendly march isn't going through, like, you know, like a badass blockade that the cops are going to be beating on. So try to keep everyone safe and knowing what they're getting into. The hope was that, like groups of people would come from far and wide and be like, we're doing this, and we're doing this, and we're doing this. And the TCMN would just make sure that nobody was getting in each other's face with tactics that they didn't want to be part of. And that didn't happen. And, like, I think what I learned is that, like, you can either be part of organizing the structure, you know, like, make the posters, make the timelines, get the convergence space, or you can be part of an affinity group that's going to do something really useful, but you can't do both. There's no way that we could have actually planned a really solid action while we were also doing all of this infrastructure stuff. And I think that was sort of the main drawback, is that there's not enough people in this city that are willing to give enough of their time, that we had enough people that could, on the one hand, be part of the TCMN, and on the other hand, be planning actions. Like, we needed the people in the TCMN to just plan an action, you know, because no one else is doing it.
Right, so it's almost a reflection of the fact that the balance of forces has changed since Seattle and the G20 in Toronto, and just in terms of, you had that spike of activity around the anti-globalization movement where literally tens of thousands, you know, even hundreds of thousands of people
mm-hmm.
would come out on the streets and be open to a wide variety of different tactics or actions.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just not the case in Toronto.
And now it really seems like, yeah, like there's fewer people on the one hand, and then people are, from both sides, are scornful of the middle, right? So there's, like, you know, people who are only willing to march and will not do anything illegal. Then there's people who are like, fuck this NVDA shit, I want to break some windows, or like, I want to, like, do something really that feels strong, that's empowering. I'm going to dress all in black and I'm going to be part of the black bloc. And from both sides, the sort of classic mass civil disobedience actions are like, are not, people aren't interested in them anymore. Like, we've lost the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, if there was a middle, maybe there would be more people. And if there was more people, maybe there'd be a middle, right? But yeah, it's definitely different. And I mean, but it's not just time. Like, I think it's also place. Like, I think if this had happened in Montreal, where there's a very different culture, where you can be part of a militant march that will confront the police, or at least defend against the police, that will, like, attack a fence or, like, a structure, like, and does this kind of on a regular basis, and doesn't dress all in black in some kind of, like, cliquey sort of subculture, it would have been a totally different demo. Like, if they had met in Montreal, I don't think the like, weird conflict between, like, the union march and the break-off, I don't think that would have existed. It would have been like, yeah, we do a break-off march, of course we do. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's, like, it's a different time, but it's also, like, it's specific to different cities, what kind of organizing culture there is, you know? I think we should all plan a big nonviolent civil disobedience next time. I mean, in the States, they've started to do it again, right?
Well, it almost seems like that's what's going on with the Occupy movement, or
mm-hmm.
and even kind of ironically, the Occupy movement has achieved tremendous political support from just being beat on by the police, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was sort of what led... You know, that's what led to them getting increased coverage around Zuccotti Park, was just getting railed on, and that coverage going viral. And then, you know, even stuff like UC Davis, where that cop was just pepper spraying these
the
students.
Meme.
Yeah. You know, I mean, But at the same time, obviously, you can look at that from the standpoint of being like, no, that's not actually empowering, and that's putting ourselves out as victims, and it's problematic in a whole bunch of ways.
Yeah. I mean, my, like, really oversimplified analysis of the Black Bloc, or just, like, it's weird to say the Black Bloc, but the kinds of things that the Black Bloc would do, is that I think we've kind of been doing it backwards for, like, the last, you know, decade, whatever, since Seattle. People have been trying to normalize the Black Bloc and to be like, the more we do it, the more people will get used to it, or like it will become appealing, it will grow. And I actually, I'm kind of looking, like, this is why it's oversimplified, because I'm looking to, like, you know, Egypt and what happened, like, this past year in Egypt, where, you know, they called a peaceful protest with, like, you know, the classic, like, women and children. And it was peaceful, and it was meant to be peaceful. And in the interviews, everyone said how peaceful it was, and that they just wanted a, like, peaceful demonstration, and that was massive to show that, like, you know, just to show their point. But there was not really a lot of conflict or tension when people started, like, defending those people against the police, and, like, you know, climbing on top of tall buildings and throwing Molotovs down when the cops came, right? And so I think that it's almost as if the Black Bloc needs to, like, you know, maybe bide their time, practice their tactics, but not in a public way, because the only time it's ever going to be acceptable here is when people feel threatened. So if the cops had attacked the labor march, I don't know that they would have been so upset about a bunch of people fighting the cops, right? Mm-hmm. Like, maybe then they would have been like, oh, yeah, this is okay. Yeah, like, my 4-year-old's here, and that's great that, like... this person all in black is, like, preventing these cops from getting too close. And so I kind of feel like, because people, like, do politics sort of, like, almost like as a hobby in some ways here, where it's like, oh, let's go out for the day and march around with the unions, then maybe they don't see a value, and so the Black Bloc looks like they're actually causing their trouble, when really all they want is, like, to be a group of people that can defend against the police, that feels like they know what the role of the police is and are ready to counter it. But the role of the police, like, is still kind of hidden from that those main marches, right? Because they don't attack them. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I don't know what that means in terms of, like, where to go from here, but I think that, yeah, like, the Occupy movement, they've got a good thing going in that they're, like, appealing to a very wide group of, like, a pretty mainstream group of people, or at least a diverse group of people, and the cops in large part are attacking them. So, I mean, that looks good on the news. I don't know that you want to kind of, like, make that your policy, like, all the time.
Yeah, well, it almost goes to show that you can, you know, certain things work well at certain times in a given condition, and then when those conditions change, you need to change with them.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you just sit there and take the police beating over and over and over again, it will be effective in terms of people will not want to come to your protest, because they'll just be like, I'm sick and tired of being pepper sprayed and, you know, yeah, beaten up.
And, I mean, in the Occupy stuff, there was that one amazing photo, right, of, like, the, I don't know, they were, like, vets, like, war vets, mm-hmm, who just, like, these kind of, like, big guys who just, like, made a line between the demo and the cops, and it's like, you know, it's kind of obnoxious, like, yeah, when the army will protect you, but, I mean, people thought that that was really awesome, and mm-hmm, I don't think that if there had been a conflict between the cops and those guys, I don't think people would have been like, no, everyone lay down, we're the victims here, like, just, like, there's a different tone when mm-hmm, it's defensive, and I think, you know, in Seattle, the Black Bloc was like, it's all about the spectacle, and, you know, breaking the spell, and, you know, like, hitting corporations in the pocketbook, which you don't do when you just smash a window. And I don't know that the spell is really being broken by, like, the concept that people have the audacity to go out there and break a window. Like, I don't know how effective that really is. But that was kind of the other side of the Black Bloc, right? Defend, de-arrest, and, like, break the spell of, like, it's okay that there's just corporations everywhere. But I that might be getting a bit old.
So I think we should probably wrap up, Mandy, but is there anything that, you know, that you think that you'd like movement people, like, as you prepare to do these 11 months in jail, is there anything that you want to tell people, or that you want, you know, people to be doing, or, you know, are there ways that they can support you while they're in jail, or ways that they can work with other prisoners, or?
That's a big question. I mean, I guess, like, the one thing I would like to tell people, because I think people have a really kind of skewed perception of what jail is that, like, it's not really going to be very terrible.
Well, because you're saying that it's almost like, you know, people are treating you as if, like, you're
dying
or something.
I know. And, yeah, and I mean, I think that's really important, and that sort of is also a part of, you know, like, it's something that people can do, and I think we used to know that, right? Like, we used to, or not we, but the movement, whatever, the 60s and 70s, like, was like, oh, yeah, you do some time in jail, you know, then you come out. And I think nowadays people have this idea that, like, jail is to be avoided at all costs, and it's, you know, the end of the world if you have to do time. And I'm hoping that, like, my experience when I can share it will be that it's, like, really, it's not so bad, and you can still do, like, important things on the inside, and you still have contact with the outside, and really, like, it's not, it doesn't take a particularly strong person to be able to get through it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's what I'd like people to know. First of all, like, not to worry, and second of all, like, that it's not, like, doesn't take, like, a particularly special person to be able to go to jail and come out okay.
And it's part of the political process.
Yeah.
If we're serious about changing the world.
Well, yeah, exactly, right? I mean, it's not like they're going to stop arresting people. And I just think that, you know, knowing that, like, I guess, like, there's only so many times that you can time in your life. So I feel like they should be worth it, you know? And, like, if you're gonna put yourself out there knowing that you could potentially do time, then I think you should make sure that your actions are, like, as efficient and effective as possible.
All right. Thank you very much, Mandy.